From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's amazing the popularity and recognition of Robert Frost's poem, The Road Not Taken. You don't often find poetry in popular culture, let's be honest. But David Orr, the poetry columnist for The New York Times, found all kinds of companies using Frost's poem in commercials. Ford, Mentos, Nicorette. Musicians have used the poem. TV shows have. Because the poem is about the importance of being an individual, having the courage to go your own way. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by. Well, that's not what Robert Frost meant. Orr says almost everyone gets the poem wrong. Today in the program, David Orr will join us to talk about how 20 lines can change the way we see the world and how the world sees us. Join us after the news.
Friend, follow, and join us on social media to stay connected with the latest goings-on. Find out who's on Radio West tomorrow, what's happening on Capitol Hill, and get a glimpse behind the microphones with pictures and videos of station staff and special events. We're on Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr, and Twitter. Search for KUER 90.1.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Robert Frost's poem, The Road Not Taken, begins this way. Two roads diverged in a yellow wood. And this is where the traveler has to make a call, has to decide which road to take. And by now, you sort of know what happens. I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. If you really pay attention, you'll find that poem everywhere, as David Orr points out in his new book, on coffee mugs and refrigerator magnets and graduation speeches. Word for word, he says, it may be the most popular piece of literature ever written by an American. But here's the thing. Orr says almost everyone gets the poem wrong. As he puts it in his book, millions of people know the language, they just don't understand what it's saying. And not only that, millions of people recognize Robert Frost without understanding what he was actually doing with the poem. Now, David Orr isn't militant about this, by the way. He does acknowledge poems aren't arguments. They're used to be interpreted, and that process of interpretation can be broad. But still, the essence of this poem is more meaningful and interesting than the version you'll find in a commercial or on your Facebook feed. His book is The Road Not Taken, Finding America in the Poem Everyone Loves and Almost Everyone Gets Wrong. David Orr is the poetry columnist for the New York Times Book Review and a professor at Cornell University. In addition, his new book about the road not taken, he's the author of a book on modern poetry called Beautiful and Pointless. He joins us today from a studio on the campus of Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. And David Orr, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Well, I wanted to start with something you write early on in the book about the role this poem has in American culture and world culture, we should say, too, because you see it as unique, the role that it's played. There's something about the poem that makes it different in the way it's influenced culture. What are you getting at there? We'll dig into this as we go, but give me a broad sense of that.
Well, broadly speaking, it's perhaps the most popular poem any American has ever written. It's, as you said in your introduction, it appears almost everywhere and not just in the United States. In fact, my book begins, as you know, with an anecdote about a commercial in New Zealand.
Right.
And in the commercial, we see a young man who is confronted with a split in the path as he's walking down a road. And then the commercial shifts into this montage of different scenes, you know, the young man doing this, like running, jumping, you know, working, meeting someone, all kinds of different things. And then the commercial resolves with the young man in a car with a woman who we take to be his wife and a sort of beautiful child in the back seat. And the young man is sort of smiling and confident. And on the roadside, you see a hitchhiker who looks like a version of his younger self. And he pulls up in his car and offers to give this guy a ride. And as this happens, the logo of the Ford Motor Company appears. And what's so interesting about the commercial is the words of the commercial are nothing but the road not taken, being read with a New Zealand accent, of course, because the commercial's in New Zealand. And I think it's fair to say that very few other American poems could be successfully used in a car commercial in New Zealand, especially if not identified in any way, you know, neither by title nor by author. I mean, it's just a measure of how much this poem's language has penetrated American culture and then by extension penetrated world culture sort of as a symbol of American culture sometimes.
Yeah. It's so interesting you lay out to sort of make the case about how popular it is. You've sort of looked at the way it was searched for on Google, for example.
That's right.
Talk a little bit about that. That's interesting too.
It is. It's one of the great advantages that the web has given writers like myself is we can now, I wouldn't say get exact answers for questions that we've had in the past, but we can get better answers for questions we've had in the past. And of course, one of the great questions that people who study poetry and who study literature in general often have is, well, exactly how popular is this piece of writing? I mean, it's not one of the main questions one asks about literature, but it is a question that comes up. And what Google used to allow you to do, they've actually changed this a little bit. It's now the service that they previously offered was called Google Insights. Now it's called Google Trends. But it allows you to sort of compare the scale of searches for certain types of language. And if you search for the title of The Road Not Taken and it's Frost, and you search against other poems, you find that the poem is searched in just enormous volume relative to other quite well-known poems from the same era, like The Wasteland by T.S. Eliot. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the search volumes that you see for The Road Not Taken are comparable really to cultural objects from other much more popular arenas like films and popular songs. And even in those cases, sometimes The Road Not Taken is actually more popular.
My favorite one was when you explained how this The Road Not Taken, 24 times more searched than anything by Ezra Pound, for example, and which you say mm-hmm. by comparison is like how college football beats archery and water polo in Google searches. That gives you
exactly.
a certain dimension. It's pretty amazing.
It is amazing. It's incredibly surprising. But, you know, one of the things that sort of went on in the background when I was working on this book, you know, my wife and, of course, my brother-in-law were aware that I'm writing a book about The Road Not Taken, so they would periodically send me pictures of random places that they would find this poem. I think my favorite of which was my brother-in-law sent me a photograph. I guess he'd gone to some restaurant and had gone to the restroom, and above the urinals they had put a big image of The Road Not Taken. Not sure what they were getting at there, but yeah, it's literally everywhere.
Well, so as you – you know, the punchline here, of course, is that pretty much everyone is getting it wrong, or most people are anyway. And this is significant, I think, and this was interesting to me because you said for the most part, most of the artistic projects and offerings that people like and that are popular are mostly understood by their audience. This seems to sort of stand out as one that most people don't seem to get.
Right, and it's almost unique in that respect. I mean, if you think about any sort of cultural offering, you know, no matter how difficult, we usually at least know basically what it is. I mean, no matter how complex it may be. I mean, you know, if you take something like Joyce's Ulysses, okay, I mean, it may be fairly hard to understand, but that's actually part of its identity. We know it's a novel that's quite difficult, and it's about, you know, wandering through Dublin, and then it's about some other things that are very confusing. We know what it is, even if we may not understand all of its aspects. The Road Not Taken is bizarre in that it's incredibly popular and incredibly well-known, and people almost, well, not all the time, but quite frequently apply an interpretation that is, you could argue, is almost the opposite of what it actually means.
Right.
The closest comparison I could come up with, and I thought about this for a while, was the Bruce Springsteen song Born in the USA.
Yes, I was thinking
which,
about that
right,
too.
Right, but you yeah. know, I do think it seems to me that most people do actually understand that the patriotism in Born in the USA is a very complex, dark sort of patriotism.
Yeah.
I think, I mean, maybe Ronald Reagan was the only person who was confused about that. But that's the best I could do. And it really pales in comparison to The Road Not Taken, where you really have just complete misunderstandings of the poem. One of the ways that I usually explain this when I give a talk about this poem is I like to juxtapose two different excerpts, one from a film and one from a television series. The first is the film Dead Poets Society. Do you remember that movie? It was Robin Williams.
Of course.
From,
yeah. Yeah.
Right. And in that film, you know, there's a great scene where Robin Williams he's of course playing this English teacher at this boys' boarding school, and he's trying to teach the boys how not to be conformists. And he takes them outside and he has them walk around, and they sort of fall into step and they start marching in step And then they start kind of chanting and he's clapping and you're thinking, well, this is what he wanted them to do. And then he has them stop and he says, do you see how quickly you all fell into step? You know, but a lot of life involves not falling into step with other people and, in fact, rebelling against this. And he says, you know, you need to be like Frost and take the road less traveled. And that, I think, is the interpretation most people take away from this poem. It's the sort of the Robin Williams Dead Poets Society interpretation.
Yeah.
But just a couple of years ago, the television program Orange is the New Black actually directly addressed this question. And the main character, Piper, gets into a discussion with two other inmates, one of whom offers the sort of Robin Williams interpretation and says, you know, I'm going to take the road less traveled from here on out. And then Piper says, well, you know, that's actually not what the poem means. In fact, the two roads are identical. And the whole point of the poem is that it doesn't really matter what you do. Your choices are essentially meaningless. And, of course, the two other inmates are not really crazy about this explanation, as people tend not to be.
Right.
But it's fascinating. Right. It's fascinating that it keeps coming up over and over and over again.
Well, the essence of it is, and we'll break this down as we go, it's
sure.
not about individualism. It's a commentary, in essence. I think this boiled it down pretty well for me, the way you said. It's kind of a commentary on self-deception, or the potential for self-deception, I guess.
Right. And to the extent it's about individualism, it's a very complex, tricky sort of individualism and not at all the sort of quite simple, well, just don't do what other people do brand of individualism that you often see attributed to this poem.
It's interesting where you stand on this because you talk about you don't want to dismiss the popularity of the poem as if to say, hey, all of you unwashed masses don't really know what this elite piece of poetry is. That's not where you are. But you also, as you say in the book, don't want to give a misreading of the poem as if it was encouraged by a fraud, that Frost also sees the unwashed masses misreading this poem and not understanding it. Because you put it this way, you say the poem both is and isn't about individualism, and it both is and isn't about a rationalization. So just give us a sense of kind of where you are on all of this before we break this poem down.
Sure. I think actually you said it quite well. My own view, I guess, is close to the view that I think Frost would have taken, which is that Frost was not in any real sense an elitist, or if he was, it was in a very roundabout sort of way. I mean, he genuinely valued and respected the large audience that he had, although he understood that sometimes that audience would not really follow everything that he was doing in a poem. And I think that when you look at this poem and you see exactly how tricky it is, you can appreciate how the sort of what I would call the standard interpretation, I'm not going to say it has total validity because it obviously doesn't. It's in some sense a misreading. But there is a sense in which it has some validity. And there's also a sense in which the poem is quite frequently been misread by people who consider themselves more sophisticated. Yeah. Now, I should say I'm far from the first person to point this out. Roughly every 10 years, a journalist will write a piece, usually when this poem appears in some large commercial, like it was actually in the Super Bowl in a Monster.com commercial, right, pointing out that the standard interpretation of this poem is almost certainly not right. But as I said, I think that the alternate frequent interpretation, which is that the poem is just sort of fatalistic, is not entirely correct either. And I think most Frost scholars today would probably agree with me about that. I think that Frost scholars, at least, are rarely deceived about this poem and certainly are not included in the subtitle of this book.
But
I think that what the poem does is it gives us a little drama of choice. And because it's a drama, it doesn't really have a winner and a loser. It just has actors. And yes, it's true that the standard interpretation is one of the less convincing actors, but it's an actor on the stage. I mean, there's a reason people like to read this poem that way.
Yeah. And that should be seen as somewhat valid, I suppose, even though it's misreading what he was getting.
Sure. Like I said, you know, the poem is in some sense about individualism. It's just a very complex sort of individualism.
I want to play a clip of Robert Frost reading this. But I want you to help me set this up because this is so interesting the way you write about the performance aspect of Robert Frost. Performance, you talk about, was really central to the way Robert Frost thought about poetry, I guess, in the sense that he didn't recite his poems, he said them.
Exactly.
Give us a sense of this, because I want people to be prepared for hearing Robert Frost read this.
Well, Frost, I think, I was going to say above all else, but you always have to be careful when saying above all else with Frost because he's so tricky.
Yeah.
But one of the things that was certainly important to Frost was that as a poet, he not be seen as a higher figure than the people he was speaking with or to.
Yeah.
And he, over the years, developed a kind of mask that was sort of that of like the rural sage, you know, kind of I'm just a farmer here wearing my work boots talking to you about poetry. You know, I might go back and clean out the chicken shed later. I mean, it was an act, but it was an act that he believed in to an extent since he actually was a chicken farmer in his early life. And he became a quite polished performer, but the key to his performance was that it not seem too much like a performance.
Yeah.
So he liked to read his poems in a very naturalistic speaking way. And whenever he would meet other poets that he was interested in, he would never ask them to read one of their poems. He would always say one of your poems, because he wanted that connection between poetry and the spoken common language to be made evident in whatever they were doing.
One of his friends, and he was incredibly influential in the creation of this poem, a man by the name of Edward Thomas, called Frost's poems revolutionary. Now, talk about what that means, because this gets us to this idea of how Frost used the common speech of ordinary people, or at least the sound, if not the
right.
essence of that. If you explain that, I think this is really interesting.
Right. I think that certainly Thomas thought, and I should say that the place that Edward Thomas plays in Frost's life is incredibly significant.
Yeah.
He's the first critic to really understand Frost. And one of the critics to best understand Frost, probably. When he says that Frost is using, as you say, the sound of ordinary speech, I think it's important to understand Frost isn't writing poems that are transcripts of ordinary speech in any way like that. I mean, he's not writing language where, you know, if we just read it out loud, you would say, oh, okay, well, that just sounds like a bunch of people talking. What he's writing is a kind of poetic version of the kind of speech that he would have heard particularly in New England, but also probably as a boy in San Francisco.
Yeah.
He's trying to keep his poetry tethered to the way that people talk. And it's, in some sense, an approach to poetry that he borrowed from Wordsworth, but he took it to a much greater and higher degree. I mean, Frost is never afraid of a poem sounding sort of banal. Mm-hmm. I mean, he rhymes star with far, you know, I mean, light with bright, things like that. Really, things that other poets would consider to be clumsy. He would do on purpose because he felt that this would tie the poem more directly to the way that we actually speak with each other and how we convey meaning through the sound of our voices as much as through the words that we're using.
And you say he wasn't replicating ordinary conversations. He was mimicking them in a way of trying to create a symbol in that cadence, I guess. Is that it?
Yeah, I think that's right. Frost poetry is, in a sense, a symbol for what you would call, I guess, ordinary language, common speech. I mean, of course, there is no real ordinary language or common speech. There's a lot of different dialects all tangled together. So the way to represent that, of course, is to make a symbol. I mean, if you tried to actually replicate it, it would just be incomprehensible almost. But right, his poetry, when you read it, is supposed to make you think of someone talking. It's probably the easiest way to say it, and I think there's a lot of truth to that. At the same time, it's not exactly like people talking because it often involves these very worked out metaphors and really beautiful sounds as well. As you were saying earlier, you know, Frost was obsessed with sound, and he thought that the way a poem communicates is like the like hearing voices talking when a door has been closed, so that you can't actually hear the words. All you can hear is the rhythm of the voices.
Mm-hmm.
He was obsessed with the idea of what he called sentence sounds.
Well, let's hear it. Let's hear Robert Frost reading The Road Not Taken, and he'll introduce it here in this clip.
The Road Not Taken. Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both and be one traveler. Long I stood and looked down one as far as I could to where it bent in the undergrowth, then took the other, as just as fair and having perhaps the better claim because it was grassy and wanted wear, though as for that the passing there had worn them really about the same, and both that morning equally lay in leaves no step had trodden black. Oh, I kept the first for another day, yet knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted if I should ever come back. I shall be telling this with a sigh somewhere ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference.
This was, we think anyway, recorded at Frost's house in 1956. It's certainly not that poet voice, is it? You know, the poet reading.
No. Right. I've been to more poetry readings than I can count over the years, and it's definitely not poet voice.
It is interesting, I think, that – and we'll put, of course, a link to the poem on our website, because I think it's important as we talk about different elements here, which you do in the book in remarkable ways. I think it's good to see it, don't you think, and sort of read it to yourself probably.
Yeah, absolutely.
David Orr is with us. His book, The Road Not Taken, Finding America in the Poem Everyone Loves and Almost Everyone Gets Wrong. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about a classic piece of American literature, Robert Frost's poem, The Road Not Taken. The writer, David Orr, says on a word-for-word basis, possibly the most popular piece of literature ever written by an American. Orr says pretty much everyone gets the poem wrong, though. We're talking about this poem and Frost, who he was, what he was doing with it. David Orr is joining us from the campus of Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. He's the poetry columnist for the New York Times Book Review and a professor at Cornell. So I guess there's an irony here that this poem, which has come to be seen as an iconic American poem, you know, of course, an iconic American ideal, was written, I guess, anyway, in England, or certainly inspired by Edward Thomas, an Englishman. Was the road that he's envisioning not a New England road, but a road that he may have encountered with Edward Thomas in England?
That's exactly right. And I think a little background might be helpful for your audience.
Yeah.
So Frost left the United States for England essentially because he had failed as a poet in the United States. Failed is maybe putting a little too strongly, but perhaps not. He'd been laboring for years in relative obscurity, mostly publishing in journals for chicken farmers like Eastern Poultrymen, and having very little success with literary magazines in New York and in Boston. And he had a fairly large family at that point, and he was sort of scraping by. He had a bequest from his grandfather that was sort of keeping him afloat, but it was a difficult life. And at a certain point, he and his wife Eleanor realized that if he was going to have a literary career, they needed to make a change. And so they actually, or at least so Frost says, they flipped a coin between moving to England and moving to Canada.
Right.
And the result was England. And I mean, it's a completely crazy thing to do. But they moved to England with their, again, four children at that point, and lived in a little house called the Bungalow. And against all odds, the move to England was exactly the sort of success that Frost had hoped that it would be. He almost immediately met a number of literary figures in England. He very, very quickly had a book picked up by a press. Mm-hmm. But more important than anything else, he met Edward Thomas. Now, Edward Thomas was a quite well-known literary critic in England at the time and also a poet, although he had sort of kept that under wraps. And he and Frost became very, very good friends. And Frost encouraged Thomas in his poetry, and Thomas helped to promote Frost's first book. And it was actually, as far as anyone can tell, a true friendship, which is rarer among poets than you might think. Usually jealousy intervenes pretty quickly, but Frost and Thomas were devoted to each other, and they were both really interested in the natural world. I mean, I was talking with the Frost scholar Bob Fagan, who was saying that, you know, Frost was really almost a professional level botanist. Mm. And so Thomas and Frost would go on walks together, and Frost was – it's always difficult to describe Frost's personality because he's a very, very complex person. But he was certainly decisive. If nothing else, he was decisive. He's the sort of person who moves to England on the basis of a coin toss.
Yeah.
Thomas was a much more doubting and wavering sensibility, and on their walks, Thomas was usually the native guide. I mean, he lived in England after all. And according to Frost, and of course one has to take things that Frost says with a grain of salt occasionally, but it seems like a reasonable story in this case. According to Frost, on their walks, Thomas would frequently doubt whatever path they would take. And he would say, oh, you know, we should have gone the other way. There's actually a much better view if we'd taken the left-hand path. And so when Frost returned to the United States right around the time of World War I, he wrote The Road Not Taken and then sent it to Thomas as kind of a joke. Mm-hmm. And the original title of the poem was Two Roads. Well, Thomas gets the poem and then writes back and says, well, you know, and takes it as if Frost is talking about himself rather than talking about Thomas. And he says, well, you know, I hope you're not, you know, regretting paths you've taken. And then, of course, Frost responds and says, no, 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 I actually had something else in mind. And he tries to throw some hints in. And they go into this back and forth that takes up six letters.
Yeah.
Before Thomas actually understands that Frost was thinking that he might take this as a little bit of a joke at his expense, you know, a good-natured joke. And then, of course, Thomas at the end of all this says, well, you know, I think you're probably going to have a little difficulty explaining this poem to readers.
Yeah.
Which has certainly proved to be the case.
Well, this gets at something you're saying about was the intent of this great American poem then just kind of a goading parody for a friend?
Well, I think not.
Yeah.
I think that Frost – that's the story that Frost liked to tell about the poem. But as I suspect Frost would have agreed, a lot of times the things that we first think about poems that we write turn out not to be actually what the object we've produced is all about.
Right.
I think the most that you can say is that there is some connection between Edward Thomas and this poem. I don't particularly think it's a goad. I don't think it really reads as a goad for a number of reasons, and I don't really think it's a parody. But I do think that it seems reasonable to say there's some connection.
Yeah. We should point out also that Edward Thomas is thinking about enlisting in the war, World War I. So that may have given – you point out this may have given him some reason to think that Frost was mocking him, I suppose. What effect did the poem have on him? We should say he did end up going to war and ended up dying there.
Right. There's some speculation, particularly by the author Matthew Hollis, who's written extensively about Edward Thomas, that he may have read the poem after he, of course, gets the full explanation as a kind of goad. Because I think, you know, let me just stress again, Frost was extremely fond of Thomas.
Yeah.
But would by no means have wanted to goad Thomas into doing anything or really make fun of Thomas in any way. But of course, there's affection between friends, and we all do make fun of our friends for the things that we find endearing about them. And Hollis at least speculates that it is possible that just the mild joke coming at this particular moment in Thomas's life when he was really debating whether or not to enlist in the army may have been something that pushed him over the edge, because of course he admired Frost very, very much, and in particular admired Frost's decisiveness and his the way in which he rarely seemed to doubt himself in any significant way. So it's possible that it could have been a goad. I mean, I just don't know, but it's a possibility, and if so, it's a sort of tragic one because Thomas died in the war.
Yeah. You have these kind of framing elements that you explore that give us some sense of the poem. The poet, of course, the poem itself. Choice is big, and the decider, the chooser, comes up too. And I want to go through some of these. The basic story about Robert Frost, we've talked a lot about that, but I wanted to ask about a couple of particular moments. There's this epigraph in this chapter on Frost, on the poet.
Mm-hmm.
Something from a letter that he wrote to Bernard DeVoto, that while he began life wanting perfection, he says, he came to live with the fact and, in fact, crave what he puts, this is how he puts it, the flaws of human handiwork. Give us a sense of how important that is for understanding Frost, sort of coming to understand imperfection and, in fact, craving imperfection in how he sees the world.
Right. Well, Frost is not what you'd call a visionary poet. I mean, he doesn't really have a utopia that he's trying to either create or mirror in some sense on the page. I mean, Frost is invested very largely in the world as it is and his life as it is, and he doesn't think of the world as a place that changes for the better particularly. That doesn't mean he doesn't think that it ever changes, but he thinks that there's something constant in human nature that involves struggle and difficulty. Momentary stays against confusion are what he says is basically the best that we can hope for. I mean, it's a somewhat dark way of looking at the world, but in some respects it's also I'm not going to say a reassuring way of looking at the world, but a strengthening way of looking at the world. I mean, if you regard the life you lead as one of almost constant struggle just to sort of keep afloat and have a moment of clarity, it can be good to see a poet who thinks of things in the same way and who gives that philosophy representation on the page.
Mm. It's interesting, too, you take note of the fact that Robert Frost was an extremely late bloomer. I mean, at 35, as you said, he was essentially a chicken farmer for a long time. And he was a nobody.
And a school teacher.
In a high school, right, a school teacher. At 35, he was kind of a nobody. And it really wasn't until he was almost 40, he was 38, that he had any literary success, as you were sort of referring to earlier. But what does that mean that he had such a meteoric rise? Because you see that as not only unprecedented, but I guess important in understanding Robert Frost, do you think?
It is, I think. I can't overstate the strangeness of his career.
Yeah.
It really makes very little sense, which probably he would have enjoyed. Right. He had almost no literary success until his late 30s. And then very, very suddenly, he became a major figure. It was just an incredibly quick transition from, as you say, essentially a nobody to being one of America's most recognized and highly respected poets. And, of course, he went on to win four Pulitzer Prizes and to read at John F. Kennedy's inauguration and to do all the things that we think about when we think about Robert Frost. But he spent a long time in the dark. And I think a lot of his attitudes later in life spring from that long period in obscurity. Frost is sometimes faulted by people for being doing little literary political moves and trying to do things to advance his career in various ways. And, I understand that, and some of them are unappealing. But if you think of the very long time that he spent writing these poems that, of course, have gone on to be some of the best-known poems anyone has ever written at any time, anywhere, and you think of how little recognition he had for them, I think a little sympathy is possible.
I want to ask you about a section you write in the book about the way Frost is developing sort of the voice in his poems. And they're like conversations. And there's one particular poem called The Pasture that I wanted to ask you about because I think it's really fascinating. Do you have the book with you? I wonder if you'd be willing to read this section. This is page 32.
Sure.
This is the poem The Pasture. Because what's so interesting about this is you talk about how well, there's this reference of you come too at the end, which I'll have you read here in a second, which I think gives a sense about this relationship that he's establishing with the audience that people have come to sort of misunderstand. But would you talk a little bit about this poem and maybe read this for us?
Sure. Why don't I'll go ahead and read it.
Great.
Okay. It's called The Pasture. And this poem, I should say, was often used as a preface to his collected poems. So he considered it important enough to put in front of all of his other poems. I'm going out to clean the pasture spring. I'll only stop to rake the leaves away and wait to watch the water clear, I may. I shan't be gone long. You come too. I'm going out to fetch the little calf that's standing by the mother. It's so young, it totters when she licks it with her tongue. I shan't be gone long. You come too.
Now, what's important about you come too? Because this invitation, you say, is a lot of effort that he's expending on an audience. It's kind of unique in that way.
Right. I mean, it's unusual for any lyric poem, and I should just say that a lyric poem, there's a lot of definitions for that, but typically what we're talking about is a shorter poem that's in a relatively unified voice. It's pretty unusual for an invitation to appear in lyric poetry to begin with. And in this case, it's just such a conspicuous invitation. You come too. I mean, there's some sort of technical poetic reasons that I can go into if you would like to, that it's a little strange in the context of the rhyme scheme and so on and so forth. But I think it's also tricky because it's hard to know whether it's a suggestion, why don't you come too, or an observation, you know, you are coming to with me as I'm saying these lines or writing these lines, you're reading them, or possibly even a directive, you know, you must come to. And one of the things that I think is so interesting is this, just the aggressive, I think I call it the ostentatious ordinariness of the writing,
yeah,
which sounds
yeah.
like maybe a little bit too ostentatious of a description. But it's the ordinariness of the poem compels us along. We're kind of at the same time being asked to come. We're having an acknowledgement that we're coming along, and we're being sort of compelled to come.
What's so interesting, too, is you say that that he pays a price for being so solicitous to his audience.
Right. I think there's no question about that.
Yeah. And this is it's important to understand this, especially when we get to the point of The Road Not Taken, how people are getting it wrong, because Frost is so solicitous. You say that some readers struggle to separate his poetry from the banalities of day-to-day talk, that, oh, he's talking about a little calf and we're going to go to the pasture. But
right.
but there's something so much deeper going on. People misunderstand him, misread it, I suppose. Is that it?
Right. I think they don't pause to question it.
Right.
Which is intentional on Frost's part.
Yeah.
I mean, for one thing, you know, when I was reading that poem, probably most people are thinking, oh, he's going to go fetch a calf. You know, it seems – it's charming and it's sort of a pastoral thing to be doing. But in fact, of course, the reason a dairy farmer fetches a calf is in order to separate it from its mother so that the farmer can take over the raising of the calf in order to make it produce milk in the proper quantities. I mean, he's going out to basically separate this animal from its mother, which is a thing that can just fly right by you if, like most of us, you don't do a lot of dairy farming. But it's something that Robert Frost would certainly have known and that he's certainly intending to invoke in the poem. I mean, Frost routinely uses this kind of very, very simple image, very, very simple phrasing to summon up a really deep and often very disturbing kind of aspect of life or aspect of language. And as I said, it tends to fly by most of us. I mean, nowhere more than in The Road Not Taken, but really in almost all of his poetry.
We should also point out how Robert Frost, he sort of goes through this process of becoming an icon, becoming a national monument. And I'm wondering what that has cost the understanding of Robert Frost, that he became a monument, you know, something not entirely human. I mean, John F. Kennedy helped make him a monument. I mean, you write about the poetry reading that he gives at the inauguration where it's kind of a great story. Do you mind talking a little bit about it? He can't actually read the poem in front of him because it's too bright, and he just goes to something that's in his mind.
Right. It's a really fascinating story. Frost, of course, is very old at this point. He would have been, let's see.
86, you say.
86, right. Just trying to do the math in my head. Yeah, and he's invited to do the inauguration, and he's quite old and sort of tottering. But of course, this is Frost, and he had his mental faculties until the very end, and so he's still a fairly ferocious personality. So he really wants to do this, and he was both fond of, and of course, as he almost was with almost everyone but Edward Thomas, competitive with John F. Kennedy. So the real worry that Kennedy has was, although I didn't actually talk about this in the book, this is true, one of the concerns that Kennedy has was that Frost would steal the show. So Frost goes up to the podium to read this poem that he's actually written for the occasion, which is this sort of clunky poem in couplets. And he's got the pages and the sun is very bright and it's cold and he can't really see the couplets he's written. And so he's sort of struggling with these papers. And it gets a little bit awkward if you watch the old video recording.
Yeah.
And Lyndon Johnson tries to use his hat to shade the papers so that Frost can see. And at the end, you're right when the scene is just about to collapse and you're just thinking, oh, this old man, how terrible for him. He just puts the papers down and recites his poem, The Gift, outright from memory. And of course, he's still a pretty powerful reader at this stage, even all the way to the end. And he recites it beautifully and the moment is completely saved. And it's one of the sort of the great moments for American poetry in many ways.
David Orr is with us. His book, The Road Not Taken, Finding America in the Poem Everyone Loves and Almost Everyone Gets Wrong, We need to take another quick break, and we'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. I'm back now with David Orr. He's the poetry columnist for the New York Times Book Review. He's a fascinating book called The Road Not Taken, Finding America in the Poem Everyone Loves and Almost Everyone Gets Wrong. It's, of course, about Robert Frost's The Road Not Taken. You say, David Orr, that the poem has confused audiences from the beginning. And the difficulty begins with the title. Originally, this wasn't the title. He had titled it Two Roads. Would you talk about that? That's interesting.
Sure. For one thing, as you probably know, many people, I might have made the same mistake, think this poem is called The Road Less Traveled.
Right.
And in fact, if you get on Google and look at search patterns and such, it's frequently searched for as The Road Less Traveled. But in fact, the title of the poem is The Road Not Taken. And we know that that was a deliberate choice because, of course, as you say, that it was initially titled Two Roads. So The Road Not Taken, the more you think about it, the stranger the title seems because, of course, the lines we remember from this poem, two roads diverged in a wood and I took the one less traveled by. Those lines fix us on the road taken, not the road not taken. So then you have to ask, well, what is the road not taken? Is it the road that the speaker didn't take? That is the road that's supposedly more traveled by more people, which, of course, not really the case if you look at the middle of the poem. Mm-hmm. Or is it the road not taken by other people, which is, of course, the road the speaker took, which is, again, supposedly less traveled? Or could it even be – are we even being sent back to the position prior to the taking of any road in which no road has been taken?
Yeah.
I mean, it's an incredibly – tricky title that seems to send us from one road to the other back and forth, which is something that seems to happen quite a lot in this poem.
Right.
I mean, I should say one of the things about the very long subtitle to this book, the poem Everyone Loves and Almost Everyone Gets Wrong. We're meant to get this poem wrong. Mm-hmm. It's a poem that wants to be misunderstood and not just by, the average person or by Robin Williams or whoever, but by everybody, including academics, including me. I mean, I don't think I have the definitive explanation for this poem. I think it's almost impossible to have the definitive explanation. It's one of the really appealing things about the poem, actually.
Yeah. Your explication in your book about choice is really interesting. And we don't have a lot of time left, but I wanted to ask you a little bit about this. You say the poem is about the necessity of choosing. Let's talk about this theme of flavor of choice, which you say this can be sort of distinctly American, this idea of choice. Huck Finn and Moby Dick, and you make reference to a letter that John Adams wrote, which was about the mm-hmm. self-determining power of selecting, making a choice. As American
right.
as action movies is how you put it. Would you talk about that part?
Sure. And I should say, just so that your readers understand, the book, essentially the second half of my book is, as you say, it's about the idea of choice and the idea of the chooser or
right.
the self that does the choosing, which are really the two main features of this poem and which I think this poem really outlines in an incredibly interesting way. As you say, America is the country of choice in so many ways. I mean, And of a very particular kind of choice. We like to think of ourselves as making as being sort of autonomous, unified entities making very distinct choices about things. And, we have anxieties about choice, and actually this poem says quite a lot about that too. But mm-hmm. we have a kind of choice that we really like to think about, which is, here I am with these decisions, and here I am this person who really has got all of his faculties marshaled, and now I'm making my decision. And I'm in command. Being in command is a very American idea, and there's a fair amount of social science to support that.
Mm-hmm.
One of the ways the poem gives us this image of choosing is through the omission of a bunch of other possible presentations of choice.
Right.
I begin the chapter called The Choice by outlining all of the kinds of choosing that don't occur in this poem. I mean, for instance, this is the drama that's being presented in the poem is one of very individual choice. I mean, the speaker appears to be completely alone. Mm-hmm. But of course, most of the choices that we make in life, or at least many of the choices we make in life, we make in consultation with other people, or right. at least surrounded by other people.
Right.
And the speaker, there's no culture around the speaker. The speaker is out in nature making a choice. There are no signs. There's no advertisements. But most of the choices that we make, or again, many of them, really involve quite a lot of culture, you know, reading a book to help us make a decision, going online to see what the information is about something so we make a decision. This speaker, though, is completely alone and out in the middle of nowhere making the starkest choice imaginable, just between two paths,
yeah.
not even between three paths
right.
or four paths.
Well, there's no pressure. There's no distraction.
Right.
There are really
right.
no moral consequences involved.
Exactly.
And there's not a choice not to choose, which I think is so interesting about the idea of a road, which you write about. I have to say, your reference to Wendell Berry was fascinating, because Berry says a path is different from a road in that it obeys the natural contours. A mm-hmm. road is an assertion of will. Does this get us to the idea that Frost is saying you can't just go your own way, that you have to make a choice?
Right. Well, this is the thing that's so tricky about the poem. He will seem to be saying one thing, but then he's also saying another thing at the very
right.
same time,
yeah.
which is, again,
yeah.
what I find so appealing about the poem. But, you know, if you think about the word road, which is a word that Frost had strong feelings about, there's an anecdote from one of his friends about having introduced him and saying something about the paths, at which point Frost broke in and said, two roads, mm-hmm. not paths.
Yeah.
There's several interesting things about roads, but as you say, the idea of the road as an assertion of will means that the speaker, the implication is that, you know, when he's doing his choosing, he's deliberately picking a path. But of course, his choice is taking place in the context of someone else's choice, the person who built the roads. So it's sort of both building up and undercutting the idea of this sort of hyper-individualized decision-making.
Mm. The final stanza, one of the most carefully placed words in the arrangement, you mention the word sigh.
Right.
Would you read that stanza again? Frost, you say, believed the word sigh was really essential to understanding the poem.
Sure. It's an incredibly tricky stanza, too. I shall be telling this with a sigh somewhere ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. So, I mean, obviously, several fairly tricky things going on there. One, which I guess we can talk about in a little bit, is the projection into the future.
Yeah,
it hasn't happened yet, which is another thing that's easy to miss in this poem. But as you say, the word sigh was incredibly important to Frost. He used to claim that it was absolutely saving, and no one has ever been sure exactly what he meant by that. There's obviously a lot of different ways to read the sigh. Is it a sigh of satisfaction? Is it a sigh of regret? Is it a sigh of confusion? I mean, it could be a lot of different things. I mean, I have a way that I like to read the word, but this is just my particular reading and probably no more valid than anyone else's. But for me, the word sigh does connect the poem in a way to Edward Thomas, who, again, you know, we can debate about how honest Frost was being when he was talking about how he wrote the poem, but it does seem to have been connected to Thomas and Frost's mind. And I should say here too, in this reading, I think I'm joining a Frost scholar named Catherine Kearns, who's written about this. But it seems to me that if you look at the last stanza, the speaker is saying, you know, somewhere down the road, I will be telling a story in which I will claim that these two roads that I have previously indicated are actually nearly identical. Are not identical, and that one of them was less traveled, and I took that road. Well, if you think about that claim, it's actually a claim that is sort of obnoxious.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, here I am. I'm going to tell you a story about myself that is somewhat self-aggrandizing. But when you think about people and the way that they work, the sort of person who says, you know, I bet years from now I'll do something really self-aggrandizing is actually the sort of person who is fairly unlikely to do the very thing he's describing. I mean, he's self-aware enough
yeah.
to be able to say that. And it seems to me that there's an element of Edward Thomas sort of creeping in here, because I think one of the things that Frost admired about Thomas was that I think in some ways he actually did like his self-doubt and found it and had compassion for it and felt like Thomas was a good man in some ways. Now, I mean, there are obviously biographers of Thomas have some difficulties with Thomas, but it seems to me one thing that you have to say is that, you know, he was a person who analyzed himself very deeply. And I think Frost admired that in some ways and thought that perhaps this last stanza does connect us to Thomas, the kind of sensibility who would accuse himself of things and would think that he would do things that he wouldn't actually do.
Let me ask you finally, you come around to this question of the crossroads, you know, two roads diverging, the importance of the crossroads, you know, that they allow us to change and to escape and emerge or disappear, you say. And the Statue of Liberty comes to mind in this idea of crossroads, the Statue of Liberty marking the threshold of the United States.
Right.
You know, would you say something about that? That, you know, it's neither here nor there, but it's a possibility? I really like
image. Exactly. I mean, this is the great crossroads poem. Just like, you know, you have Robert Johnson with the great crossroads song, yeah. This is the great crossroads poem and one of the great crossroads emblems. I mean, the emblem of the crossroads is, of course, an ancient, ancient emblem in Western literature. And it's the place that where everything and nothing happens. I mean, it's pure potential. You know, when you're at the crossroads, you haven't gone one way or the other. And in fact, it's the solution to one of the poem's riddles. The very beginning when Frost says, you know, two roads diverge in a yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both and be one traveler, long I stood. The idea that you can't travel both and be one traveler in some sense, of course, seems very obvious. But there is one place where you can travel both and be one traveler. You can travel both and be one traveler at the crossroads.
David Orr. This book, The Road Not Taken, Finding America in the Poem Everyone Loves and Almost Everyone Gets Wrong, joined us from the campus of Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. David Orr, thank you very much for the time.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.